I'm going to assume probably not. I asked one of my favorite abstract painters, Irish artist Lola Donahue, how she feels about BWCs. Her studio is bursting with giant, perfect white squares and rectangles hung on every inch of wall space, as she has several pieces in progress at any one time. That sounds like my nightmare. I asked Lola to share her perspective, and I was totally inspired by her answer. I love a blank canvas. I especially love big blank canvases. It is my favorite part of the painting process. Once I have stretched and primed a new canvas, I'm itching to get at it. It's that lovely moment when I feel so free to paint whatever I like. No constraints or restrictions, not bound by anything. Don't get me wrong, I do have a plan, but it's not set in concrete. My pieces are an emerging process, part planned, part creative accident. Abstract work lends itself to this quite nicely. I can begin with a drawing. I use chalk, marker, or anything that comes to hand as a kickstart. Then I just go for it, putting as much color and paint onto the canvas as I can. I don't think about what I'm painting at this stage, as that can stifle me. It's more about being expressive and the actual act of painting. Something usually unfolds, something accidental, and often this dictates the direction of the piece. It might be totally different than what I had planned. The original idea or drawings could be completely covered over. And that's okay. I just go with it. I'm not precious about my work, and often just paint over something entirely and start again on a whim. Yep, Sagittarius. My paintings are like a long road trip, with many different scenes and moods along the way. And, as on any long road trip, in Ireland at least, you'll surely hit a pothole or two. This is why I work on about 10 canvases at a time. It allows me to switch back and forth between pieces. I'll bring a painting to a certain point, and when I can go no further, I have others waiting in varying degrees of completion. Drying rates with oils can also dictate the different stages of the piece. I am lucky in that I'm a full-time painter, and I can come and go from a piece as I choose. Life gets in the way too, so I might leave a painting for a few days or weeks and then come back to it with fresh eyes. I might decide it's finished, or I might start on it again. I often paint over the part I love the most. That releases me from the ties I have with that particular part of the painting, and in doing so, renews the creativity. I generally find, though, that the bigger the canvas, the better. It's the small ones I find challenging. Yes, blank pages can be blinding. But the larger the surface area, the greater the creative rewards when you reveal the hopes and promises hidden underneath. Try it and see. Now I want to buy a new stack of big white canvases. Perhaps this time I will take Lola's lead and let go a little. Note to self. Put lots of marks on the canvas. There are no mistakes, just creative accidents. Don't be precious. Work on multiple pieces at a time. Embrace the occasional pothole. Ugly is a perfect place to start. Clearly, some of us have a fear of big canvases, while others are intimidated by the little ones. Personally, I'm terrified of both, but I'm working on it. One nagging fear seems to be quite common for most creative people as they set out to make something new. What if it's bad? Yes, what if it is bad, on purpose? That's right. Face that fear head on. Go out of your way to make something really bad. Whether that's a painting, a collage, a short story, or a song, set out to make the worst painting, collage, story, or song the world has ever encountered. Why, you ask? I'll let maker, writer, and ugly expert Kim Worker tell you. She has mastered and totally embraced the idea of purposely making terrible things. I ask Kim to give us a lesson in Ugly 101. Here's her insight. We hear so much these days about how valuable failure is, about how we should embrace it as growth and learning and opportunity. And sure, failure's great, but it's great after the fact. And let's be totally honest, sometimes it's only great after a decade or after therapy, or both. Nobody goes into starting a project, whether it's small, like a sketchbook spread or a journal entry, or huge, like writing a book, preparing for a gallery show, or scoring a film, thinking about how valuable it might be to fail. That would be nuts. Of course, you can play the mind trickery of telling yourself that the brand new project will be an amazing experience no matter how it turns out. But that's still an exhausting amount of mind trickery. I know, because that used to be the way I went into a project when I was in a cold sweat staring at a blank page. I was a master mind tricker. Not the most impressive skill to boast. Now I just throw one project under the bus right off the bat. I make something that's intentionally ugly, grotesque even, because that's what an epic failure would be, right? So I make something totally revolting, and then I gloat a little over how capable I am of spectacularly failing, and then I start over, knowing that whatever it is I do from that point forward will have to be better than my ugly thing. That knowledge is freeing, my friends, and free is a fabulous way to feel at the very beginning of a project. Give it a shot. Simply brilliant, and a ridiculous amount of fun, especially when done with a group of friends on a Friday night with some delicious food, and maybe a glass of wine or two. I highly recommend organizing a group of your friends to try a bad art night. See Chapter 9, Creating in a Vacuum Sucks, about creating your own creative tribe. You'll eat, you'll laugh, you'll intentionally make the worst creation that you possibly can, and by failing so epically, you'll all win. Deer in Headlights. The bad work is now out of your system. Huzzah! Wonderful and very liberating. You're inspired, recharged, and officially ready to work on that thing. You know the one. That thing that you've been thinking about working on for ages. Even though you loved every moment of Bad Art Night, old habits die hard. You may find yourself reaching for a fresh sheet of blank paper, and then staring at it, waiting for a totally original, never-before-seen idea to magically appear. That's a surefire way to set yourself up for an incredibly frustrating afternoon. Here's the thing. Some days, the paper is really, really blank. Everyone, and I mean everyone, has days when they can't fill the page, and that's absolutely fine. That is not failure, and it's certainly not a reason to quit. It is, however, a reason to look for clever ways to move forward. Here are some ideas. Rule number one, make some rules. First things first, you need to create a jumping-off point for yourself so that those white pages aren't quite as blinding. Even that crazy, blank, canvas-loving Lola Donahue creates a starting point using chalk and markers. An easy way to find that starting point is to simply make some rules for yourself. Remember? That was the scary part at the beginning of this chapter. Endless possibilities and no rules in sight. So let's make some. Most of the creative professionals that I've talked to do this for every single project. Their advice? Set constraints and then play within them. It's basically like an assignment in school. When you make rules that you're not allowed to break, you can focus. You've got a plan. Here's my top 10 list to get you started. Top 10 rules to play within. 1. Always have a big stack of paper. If there's only one perfect surface staring back at you, it instantly becomes way too precious. Have enough paper that you won't worry about ruining it with your words and or marks. Your inner critic will have a lot less power against a whole stack of paper. It thrives when you're worried about that one perfect sheet. Note, be cheap. Make sure that your big stack of paper isn't thick and fancy. Don't buy a beautiful, expensive, linen-bound notebook. The pricier the supplies, the more nervous you'll be about what you're going to do to them. Grab a pack of printer paper for $5 and voila, no pressure. 2. If clean white paper is too scary, start with a surface that already has something on it, either text or images, and find inspiration or a starting point from what already exists there. Incorporate those words, images, or marks into your new piece. 3. Learn to let go. Chop up an existing image, something you made or a found image. Rearrange it and create a completely new composition. This does two things. First, it removes that whole precious issue. The minute the scissors come out, precious goes out the window. Second, you are now free to work with these new pieces in a completely fresh way. This is my go-to activity when I'm feeling stuck, and it works for me almost every time. 4. Choose one color that you love and then gather all of your supplies, paint, pens, tape, bits of paper that you own in that particular color. Make something using only those supplies. 5. Pull a sentence from a random place, Twitter, the newspaper, an overheard conversation, and make that the first sentence in your story, poem, song, or make a piece of art inspired by that sentence. 6. Tell your inner critic where to go. On that blank surface, paint or write a message to your inner critic. You can be polite or rude. I usually opt for rude. Now paint over it. Part of your message may show through a little bit, which is great. This is your starting point. It's also strangely comforting knowing that there is a secret message buried beneath your work, a reminder to your inner critic that you're too busy being creative to listen to its nonsense. 7. Collaborate. Ask someone close to you, a friend, a coworker, a kid, to make the first mark. Don't watch or try to control it in any way. Just let them scribble, draw an actual object, write a word, then say thank you, and you take it from there. 8. Flip it around. Forget the white page with a black pen. Use a black page, white pen. Draw the negative space. You're not drawing the vase. You're drawing where the vase isn't. Oh, hello, back brain. Nice to see you. 9. Screw art supplies. Head to the grocery store instead. Work on any kind of cheap, readily available surface you can find. Paper plates, paper cups, lunch bags, and draw, paint, write on that instead. If it's not a traditional, creative surface, you might be less likely to get tripped up on your usual hang-ups. 10. Cut it down to size. Take one perfect, precious sheet and cut it into 25 little bits. Create tiny work on each one, knowing full well that they're too tiny to be considered final pieces, therefore removing the pressure. I'm sure you'll have a few favorites in the pile of 25. Take those and recreate them on larger sheets. Still no need to use fancy paper, though. Now you've got at least 10 tricks up your sleeve, and the possibilities are still endless, but the difference is you're making the rules. Grab that stack of blank paper and show it who's boss. Chapter 5. A green eye is a green light. Comparison is the thief of joy. Theodore Roosevelt. Jealousy. This is a big topic. It's one of the 7 deadly sins, for crying out loud. You may try to run away, but I've learned from experience that jealousy will chase you, breathing down your neck, hot on your heels. The only way to get rid of this toxic emotion is to face it head on. Yes, stop running and turn around. Stare straight into those big green eyes, show no fear, and then make jealousy work for you. It's totally normal to be jealous of people who are doing the things you wish you were doing. Believe me, I know. That, however, does not mean you should allow yourself to stew in jealousy for days or weeks or years. Take the time to figure out exactly why you're jealous, and this will become your green light to go and get things done, turning this negative emotion into something positive. Once you're moving in the right direction, that green-eyed jealousy won't be able to keep up. Jealousy was my green light. Before I started The Jealous Curator, I was, well, jealous. I was trying to get back into making art after taking a self-imposed decade-long hiatus. See Chapter 7, No One Can Wrestle the Pencil Out of Your Hand, for the reason behind that. So naturally, I jumped down the rabbit hole that is the internet. Did I find artists I liked? Yes, thousands of them. When I discovered work that I loved, I'd have an immediate 50-50 reaction. First, I would be so excited, heart racing, my cheeks flushed with inspiration. I couldn't wait to grab a fresh canvas and get to work. Then, only minutes later, I would feel totally defeated, my inner critic chiming in along the way. It's all been done in every color. Besides, you could never do it as well as, insert any name here. Why bother? Let's take a nap instead. I was bitterly jealous. It was breaking me and completely stopped me from living the creative life I so badly wanted to be living. After months of wallowing around in this poison, I'd had enough. It was time to take some control over the situation. I was jealous. But instead of letting it eat me alive, I decided to stare it down, arm wrestle it, and then flip it on its head. Within a month or two of writing posts as The Jealous Curator, I was feeling like a totally new person. It was like taking a deep, cleansing exhale. I slowly began to uncover the secrets that would turn my jealousy into admiration, and then I wrote them down. Say it out loud. It is that simple. Say it out loud. Yes, just tell the person you're jealous of that you're jealous of him or her. Here's why. If nothing else, it will make the other person feel great, and that will make you feel good too. Saying it out loud in a positive way instead of keeping it bottled up inside transforms jealousy into admiration. The person you're jealous of could very well be jealous of you too. Seriously. I started saying it out loud almost by accident through the daily posts on my website. By writing about the artwork I loved, I was mastering the first 2 points without even trying, and it felt amazing. A few months after I launched The Jealous Curator, I decided that I wanted to try one of these "I'm jealous of you" conversations in person. Scary, but it had worked online. Why not add a little face-to-face and a fancy latte to the equation? This experiment took place over coffee on a pretty outside patio. When I confessed my green-eyed jealousy to my coworker, Mary Jo, she was stunned, and then she burst out laughing. She explained that she had been jealous of me all this time. It turned out we both had a lot of amazing things going on that neither of us had fully recognized in ourselves. And with that realization, my wishing days were over. I was ready to be a doer. Who in your life are you jealous of? Draw these people in closer. Your admiration may convert these talented people from being objects of your envy into your close creative confidants. They may become the ally you reach out to when you're in a creative block or feeling insecure. People you admire are ideal brainstorm partners. Wouldn't it be great to get some of their secret sauce in your work? None of this will happen unless you swallow your pride and admit your underlying admiration. See Chapter 9, Creating in a Vacuum Sucks, for more tips on finding your creative tribe. Write it down. Dear so-and-so, your amazingness drives me nuts and I'd like to tell you why. If you're feeling nervous or shy before your confession coffee date, this is a great trick to get your thoughts straight. In some cases, it may be your only option. For example, what if your jealousy alarm is set off by someone you don't know? A friend of a friend of a friend, a celebrity, an artist who died 100 years ago, or maybe an ex who you really don't want to have coffee with. Sometimes saying it out loud won't work. No problem. Write a letter that you do not send. It's not quite as satisfying, but at least it allows you to articulate what's bothering you. Now, take a look at that letter and grab a fresh sheet of paper for the next step. Make an admiration action list. Your action list should be based on the things that make you jealous about a particular person. He or she goes for a run every morning before work. You hate running. Okay, then it's probably not the act of running that makes you jealous. Perhaps it's the individual's balanced lifestyle that you want. Put something on your action list that works for you. Morning meditation, yoga, a walk, the gym. Next, does the other person make or write one thing every day? If that is something you'd like to be doing too, then pop it onto your list. Break it down jealous item by jealous item. Pin the list up in your studio or put it up on your fridge. This is now your plan. Look behind the curtain. The object of your jealousy has a big show opening in New York or a novel hitting shelves worldwide. What a lucky person. Really? Or did the object of your jealousy wake up every morning at 5 a.m. to work on the project before everyone else in the house got up? Did he or she just get handed this huge show, or is it the result of hustling for years, showing paintings on any wall available from coffee shops to tiny galleries in the bad part of town? It's easy to be jealous of others' success and to assume that they miraculously arrived at the top of their field. Look behind the curtain and take notes. What they have is the trigger for your jealousy, but what they do may become part of your plan to get on a similar path. Sometimes the jealousy you feel toward these rock stars in your life comes from insecurity in your own work. But if you don't fear failing, see Chapter 8, Failure Leads to Genius, you can play and experiment until you arrive in a place where you feel confident and proud of yourself. Slowly but surely, you'll begin to let go of that soul-crushing jealousy you feel when you see what other people are making. Sure, there may still be a pang of, damn, I wish I thought of that, but now, instead of allowing it to stop you, you can use it to move yourself forward. Find inspiration, avoid imitation. When you find a painting, a book, or a song that truly speaks to you, sometimes the knee-jerk reaction is to copy it. Oh, I love that, I'll make something just like it. Sound familiar? Well, you're not alone. I did this for years. I jumped around, changing my style every time I found work that I loved. I felt like a crazy person, with no style or point of view of my own. Finally, about a year before I started The Jealous Curator, I had an idea. A brand new idea that no one else in the world had ever thought of. I was officially an artistic genius. The idea flashed into my mind one day while playing with my son, who was 2 at the time. I was an at-home mom. We spent a lot of time being dogs and sheep and any animal that he decided to be that day. I loved watching him, and so I did a whole series of collages that featured kids' bodies with animal heads. I was so proud of myself. Until I started the blog. Literally on the first day of looking for work to post, I found 5 artists doing exactly the same thing. Exactly. I was devastated and frustrated and strangely jealous of those other artists for thinking of my brilliant idea before I did. For once, I hadn't copied, but I might as well have. Damn. Back to the drawing board. In fact, getting shoved back to the drawing board was actually a creative blessing. This little animal head fiasco challenged me to think about what I was trying to articulate. Was there another way I could visually represent that idea? Of course there was. I just needed to get into the studio and push myself past the first idea. There I was, genuinely believing I was the first person to put animal heads on kids, while I'm quite sure those other 5 artists thought that they were geniuses too. The bizarre thing is, often there's just something collective going on in the universe. Geometrics are trendy. Flowers have been a go-to subject matter for centuries. And there might just be more than one novel about vampires. As for collage work, it has a very unique issue all its own. A lot of collage artists use the same vintage images, not because they're stealing from each other, but because of copyright guidelines. The result is these artists end up using images from the same time period. National Geographic 1950, anyone? So their final pieces will look similar. In any creative discipline, it's wonderful to be inspired by others. How sad would it be if you weren't? But then it's your job to alter, remix, combine, transform, and challenge yourself to make those found images, floral still life paintings, and vampire stories, into something unique. You'll find yourself creating work that is influenced by the world around you, but that is truly your own. Your green light assignment. As you were reading this chapter, who popped into your mind? Was it other creative people? A superstar at your office? A perfect mom at the park? It doesn't matter who you're jealous of or why. What matters is that you find a way to turn that toxic flow of jealousy into something positive. Write down those names, the reason why you're jealous, and then start setting up the coffee dates or writing letters. Be open and honest and buckle up. Your stoplight is about to turn green. Chapter 6. Your inner critic is a big jerk. Oh, that voice. It is the root of so much trouble. It shows up with cruel comments, snarky jabs, and is always armed with a long list of reasons and excuses for quitting. It prevents talented people from doing amazing things, often stopping the flow of creativity before it even starts. It sits on your shoulder, whispering hurtful words that plant the poisonous seeds of self-doubt. What a jerk that inner critic is. But wait, I have good news. Your inner critic isn't in charge. You are. You can quiet that voice and even bury the hatchet, turning that manipulative jerk into a trusted ally with just a bit of effort. Okay, maybe a lot of effort. We better get started. An investigative assignment. First things first, where did this annoying voice come from? It certainly wasn't there when you were glitter gluing feathers and macaroni onto colored sheets of paper. When, how, and why did that inner critic's voice show up? It's time to launch an investigation. Step 1. Identify the voice. Do you know who your inner critic sounds like? Is it the voice of an unsupportive teacher from your past? A parent who didn't encourage a creative path? A professional critic who panned your work? The first step in silencing this voice is to recognize where it originated. It's important to acknowledge that this voice is not part of you. It's a collection of negative words and experiences that derive from external sources. That voice doesn't belong in your head unless it can learn to support you. Step 2. Pinpoint the attack. What and when is your inner critic attacking? Does it pop up only when you're writing? Maybe it's quiet when you're cooking a gourmet meal, but shows up when you paint. Unless you pay attention to this, it may feel like your inner critic is there 24/7. But I can almost guarantee that that's not the case. It preys on insecurity. When you're doing things that you enjoy, creative endeavors that come easily to you, that little voice slinks off to sulk in the corner. Take note of those moments and bookmark them. We're going to come back to this. Step 3, unmask the guilt. Inner critics can sneak into your life in the form of guilt. Parent guilt, family guilt, work guilt. This guilt convinces you that creative pursuits are frivolous and that focusing on them is a waste of time. Your inner critic flourishes in that guilt-filled environment. It's like mold thriving in a damp, warm room. Just imagine if everyone fell victim to this. What if Leonardo da Vinci felt like painting the Mona Lisa was a waste of time? Or if J.K. Rowling had allowed mom guilt to stop her from writing the Harry Potter books? When you unmask that guilt, guess who you'll find? Yes, it's your inner critic hiding back there, sneaky jerk. The sooner you do this investigation, the better. Once the mystery is solved, you'll be that much closer to silencing that unhelpful little voice. In fact, just acknowledging that you have an inner critic and understanding where it comes from takes some of its power away. You can gather up its nasty comments and dismiss them instead of believing them as truths. Soon, you'll begin to realize that they're just a collection of fear-based words coming from an insecure bully. Stand up for yourself. Speaking of bullies, here's an interesting experiment. Write down one of your inner critic's usual jabs. Go ahead. Do it right there in the margin of this book. Mine usually says something like, "You're such an amateur, and if you actually make work, people are going to find out that you have no idea what you're doing." Yes, something wonderful like that. Write yours down and then read it out loud at full volume. Now let me ask you this. Would you ever, ever say these words to someone else? A friend, a colleague, a student, a child? No, of course not. So why on earth do we speak to ourselves in such a harsh, abusive way? In fact, if you overheard someone say this to your friend, you'd jump immediately to their defense. This, my friends, is a major case of bullying. Each and every one of us should be carrying signs, marching in a circle and chanting, "No to bullying." I can see the t-shirts already. So, the next time your inner critic has something to say, pay attention. If it's a statement that you would never, ever think of saying to another human being, then jump in and defend yourself. Wash that bully's mouth out with soap and send it packing. Experts have it all, including self-doubt. It's hard to believe, but even people at the top of their creative game have inner critics and the occasional bout of self-doubt. It seems like professional artists, authors, and musicians must have it made. They're living the dream. Surely they would never spend a moment second-guessing their creative choices. But they do. When I interviewed the 50 visual artists in my first book, Creative Block, one of the questions I asked was, "Do you ever hear your inner critic?" I actually hesitated to send that question because my inner critic told me that these very accomplished artists would respond with, "My what? No, I don't have that, you amateur." Well, I'm glad I ignored that negative opinion and asked them anyway. All of the artists confirmed that they do, in fact, hear little whispers in their ear all the time. However, what makes these professionals excel is that they do not allow those little whispers to stop them from leading a creative life. Yes, they may have an inner critic and the occasional bout of self-doubt, but they also have dedication. They keep making, whether the work ends up on the gallery wall, on the stage, in a novel, or in the garbage bin. They continue to create every single day. Time. They make space and time to be creative. They don't put their work on the bottom of their priority list. Being creative is their priority. Trust. A lot of successful professionals trust that little voice. When it speaks up, they know that they're probably heading down the wrong road. Over years of working together, they've become friends. Friends who disagree from time to time, but ultimately, they have the same goal, great work. The silver lining. As much as I hate to admit it, even jerks are right sometimes. Granted, they could find a more constructive way to deliver the message. In order to get back in the driver's seat, you'll have to hone your translation skills. Once you actually know what your inner critic is trying to say, you can decide what to do with that information. Here are a few things to consider. Take it with a grain of salt. In most cases, bedside manner is not a strong suit of the inner critic. It might be telling the truth, but because the message is being delivered by a jerk, it's really hard to listen to. Giving up, throwing your work away, and eating junk food sounds like a much better idea. But don't do that. Take a deep breath, weed through the junk, and then translate those harsh words. Is there some truth there? Even just a little nugget? Maybe. For example, if you hear, How many unrelated images can one person put on a collage? Have you ever heard of editing? True. Perhaps you did get a little carried away. Take that feedback and translate it into something that's actually helpful and proactive, such as, this feels a bit busy. Here's an idea. Slice this up into several small pieces and make a whole series of simple collages from each strip. There, now you're in charge. You've distilled the message, and you can take it at face value. Then it's your call if you want to apply it to your work or not. Explore a different angle. Perhaps what your inner critic is trying to tell you is the problem is the format, not the medium. Are you trying to write a huge novel but find it overwhelming? Maybe you should start an anonymous Twitter account and write in 140 characters for a while. If painting on canvas isn't working for you, don't quit painting. Just try changing your surface. Give vintage found paper a shot. Just keep going, even if it's in a slightly new direction. Discover a new path. This goes hand in hand with step two in our investigation from the beginning of this chapter, pinpointing the attack. Pay attention to when your inner critic has something to say. For example, I have almost no insecurities when it comes to my blog and all things Jealous Curator. I'm proud of myself, never second-guess my choices, and almost never hear a peep from that little voice. As a collage artist, I only hear it from time to time, and I can usually work past the rude comments. But when I try to paint, well, the only thing I can hear is, "You should never paint again." Maybe you don't hear anything when you're drawing, but you hear it while writing. Perhaps you can play an entire guitar solo without one whisper, but it screams if you try to sing. We often discount the skills that come easily to us. They don't count because we're not suffering. Artists are supposed to suffer for their craft, after all. On the other hand, perhaps your inner critic has a point. Forcing yourself down a path that you're not enjoying, just to prove that you can do it, isn't a great idea. Of course, keep working on new skills that you want to conquer, and if you can begin to trust that voice, you might just turn a creative corner. A wise man once said, "Everybody is a genius, but if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing that it is stupid." Albert Einstein. As a painter, I felt like that fish trying to climb a tree, but the minute I embraced being a collage artist, because I'm actually good at it and genuinely love creating this way, I felt like I was set free to swim. See Chapter 8, Failure Leads to Genius. If you listen carefully and do a bit of translating, your inner critic might just nudge or shove you down a new path, and then you can finally get on with the business of being a genius. Turn the critic into a cheerleader. Why doesn't that little voice ever pipe up when you're succeeding? What about a nice, "Hey, way to go, you proved me wrong"? Nope, just silence from the peanut gallery. Until you're working on something new, and then that little voice shows up again. Why can't it say, "You're gonna knock this one out of the park, just like last time, you superstar"? Instead, it comes back with, "Well, sure, that last thing was okay, but what are the chances you can pull that off twice?" This voice is incredibly influential. But why is its great power only used for evil? Let's flip this whole thing around, like a fancy back handspring, and make that voice cheer for us instead. Give it a new name. Confession. I actually really don't like the term inner critic, even though it's on the cover of this book. It feels almost impossible to turn a phrase that is 50% critic into anything remotely warm and fuzzy. I've heard other people refer to their inner critic as mini-me, that voice, the opponent, and a few things that we'd have to bleep out. But my absolute favorite name came from a young writer who I recently met. He calls his inner critic Arlo. I want an inner critic named Arlo. Sure, Arlo might have a bad day from time to time, but I feel like we'd have a better shot at being friends than me and my inner critic. Do you already have another name for yours? If not, give this rebranding exercise a try. Rewrite the script. When you are working or thinking about working and your inner critic pipes up with something mean, negative, or annoying, stop what you're doing and write those words down. Right below that, flip the statement around and write the positive opposite of whatever your inner critic just said. Read it out loud, at full volume. Make a conscious choice to listen to that comment instead. You can even hand letter or collage a few of the best ones and pin them to your wall. After a few months, you'll have a studio full of lovely, encouraging works, which are great to read on the days when Arlo is in a bad mood. Prove it wrong. That little voice says you can't paint? Do a few quick, fun painting assignments. They may not be ready for the walls of MoMA, but you did in fact paint. It said you couldn't, but you just did. Do it again and again and again until it starts to believe in you. Talk about pros, not cons. Not long ago, I was teaching a workshop at a high school arts festival. I asked the entire group, kids aged 14 to 18, if they knew what I meant by inner critic. Unfortunately, they all knew exactly what I meant. During the break, a very kind, smart, and thoughtful 17-year-old boy named Lucas asked if he could talk to me about his inner critic. Lucas had just finished writing a play, one that he had worked on for ages and was proud of. Wonderful, right? But he told me that his inner critic made sure that Lucas recited a detailed list of everything that wasn't quite right before he handed the pages to anyone to read. I would much rather be on the winning team, Lucas told me. Winning team? I was confused. Yeah, I want to be teamed up with the person I'm showing my play to, both of us united against the work. Apparently, the losing team was Lucas and his play, the play he was proud of. He would rather throw his play under the bus than stand beside it for fear of getting run over, too. We both agreed that he and his play didn't deserve this, nor does anyone's work. So many people create this list of negatives, disclaimers, or excuses when sharing their work, as if to create a magical protective shield against criticism. Why introduce these negative ideas into the recipient's otherwise open, objective mind? Instead of spending precious time preparing a mental list of everything that you're not happy about, come up with a list of things you love about this work. Granted, in your mind, the work might not be perfect. There may be a version 2.0 in your future. But be proud and acknowledge the parts that you really love. That puts you and your work on the winning team and throws your inner critic under the bus all alone. Say thank you. Never speak badly of your own work. Remember, say no to bullying. When someone compliments you, say thank you. Even if, like Lucas, you secretly want to give them an itemized list of flaws. For example, if a friend says, "I love that drawing," and you respond with, "Well, I don't love that top part, and I didn't have the kind of pencil I really wanted to use, and it should probably be a bit bigger," your inner critic will be in heaven, rolling around and basking in all the negativity. To thwart your inner critic, just smile, say thank you, and practice being proud of yourself, even if you're totally faking it. Your inner critic will be so confused by this new behavior, it might just hop on the bandwagon and start cheering right along with everyone else. A new friend? Okay, calling your inner critic a friend might be pushing it at this stage, but you can transform that voice into a trusted truth-teller, an ally whose advice is worth listening to. Take it or leave it, trust it or not, but if you want to be in charge, there is only one thing you need to remember. Do not quit. A real friend, one who's worth trusting, would never tell you to give up on your creative dreams. Chapter 7. No one can wrestle the pencil out of your hand. Criticism. The act of passing severe judgment, censor, fault-finding. Dictionary.com. Ouch. That doesn't sound good at all. Now, just to be totally clear, there is good criticism. Really. When it's constructive and comes from a kind and trusted source, feedback is one of the most valuable things you can be given as a creative person. What I'm talking about here is the hurtful and harsh kind of criticism that stops you in your tracks and does nothing but damage. That kind of criticism sucks. Me Too stories. I used to believe that I was one of the few people to be bashed down and stopped by criticism. I have learned that that is definitely not the case. When talking to people about my book, Creative Block, I was stunned by how many Me Too stories I heard. Some starred actual professional critics, but the majority of stick-in-your-head-forever tales were filled with the harsh words from trusted sources like parents and teachers. I cannot emphasize enough how important both parents and teachers are in fostering creative self-esteem, or its opposite. Constructive criticism at the right moment can fuel someone to become better, stronger, and more successful. Negative criticism, at just the wrong moment, on the other hand, can have a lifelong negative effect on how people see themselves creatively. In Chapter 1, Everyone is Creative, we talked about the telling response, "Me? No, I'm not creative." This is probably exactly where that comes from. Whether criticism comes from teachers, parents, friends, coworkers, or actual professional critics, it can knock you down and stop you forever. But it doesn't have to. You can get back up, dust yourself off, and keep going. I have gathered stories from some very creative people who have done exactly that. And because it would be a totally chicken out move for me not to tell my own story, that's where I'll start. My story. I was the art kid. I painted, sewed, wrote stories, put on plays, and glued beads on everything. I entered every coloring contest I could find, and in high school I was the art coordinator for the yearbook. That said, I also liked science. My mom is an artist, and my dad is a PhD-wielding scientist, so I had both influences in my life. When it came time for university, after much internal debate, I decided to study marine biology. It felt more responsible than going into art. I wasn't completely confident that my love for art could be anything more than a passionate hobby, a very common but not necessarily valid misconception. See Chapter 2, Excuses Are the Enemy. Near the end of my first year, my dad said, "I think you should switch into fine arts. It's who you are. It's who you've always been." When I asked him how he thought I might pay for things like food and rent, he very calmly said, "Do what you love and the money will come. And if it doesn't, you won't care because you'll be happy." Pretty amazing. I listened. With excitement and a touch of nervousness, I switched into the BFA Visual Arts program. Imagine then the art kid's surprise when she did not fit in at art school. At all. For the next 3 years, I did my best, but I felt very alone. I struggled with, well, everything. I got fairly used to getting bashed and critiques and was definitely developing a thicker skin. Ultimately a good thing, I suppose. Yet not thick enough for the critique that came 6 weeks before I graduated as a painting major. I had been working on a series for my final show, and it was my turn to share my work with the class. I prepared myself for the usual bashing, but my professor, let's call him Joe, who usually hated everything I did, loved my work. Huh? He went on and on about how I'd found a new niche, how he hadn't seen anything like this before. At the end of that class, he told us that an artist from New York would be visiting our studio the following week, and that three people could show their work. Everyone sat quietly, nervous about voluntarily putting their work in front of a real artist. Not I. I raised my hand immediately. Why not? I just had the best critique of my life. I put up the same five pieces I'd shown the week before, and then got ready for what was meant to be a 10-minute discussion. 30 very long minutes later, I sat stunned and red-cheeked as my entire class tore the work apart, my professor leading the pack. He actually said, and I quote, "You should never paint again." I was so confused. Normally I could defend my work, but I was just so blindsided by how radically my teacher had changed his tune that I couldn't even speak. I could feel the hot tears perched just behind my eyelids, ready to stream down my face the moment the first word left my mouth. I was already so embarrassed in front of the visiting artist. I certainly didn't want to cry in front of him as well. He was incredibly kind, though, and moved his chair from across the room to right beside mine. He gave me a quick wink of support, but by that point, the damage was done. I had so many projects to finish before the final graduation show, and the only thing I could hear was, "You should never paint again." I second-guessed every stroke, every idea, every single little thing. I graduated, but I felt broken. I tried to keep making art, but I could never quiet that voice. That voice that slowly, over time, became my jerk of an inner critic. It would be almost 15 years before I felt confident enough to make fine art, let alone show it to anyone. But I did. And if you look at the positive side of the story, I actually had that teacher to thank for a big part of the success I've had in recent years. If not for that very defining moment early in my art career, I never would have had the need to start the Jealous Curator. So thanks for everything, Joe. I couldn't have done it without you. Now, this is not just an art thing. It's a creativity thing. I have talked to many visual artists about their crushing criticism stories, but I've also found myself in conversations with actors, designers, and writers. And their stories are exactly the same. When I decided to write this book, and this chapter in particular, I just knew I had to reach out to some of those people and ask if they'd be comfortable sharing their Me Too stories. All of them jumped at the chance to share their tales of crushing criticism, how it knocked them down, and how they picked themselves back up. The first story I want to share is shockingly similar to my own. It takes place in the theater department at UCLA over a decade ago. Autumn Reiser, actor, the OC Entourage Hawaii 5-0. I started theater school from a very different place than most of my classmates. In high school, I had been all about external achievements. Type A and teacher's pet were good words for me. And most of my college classmates were from the darker side of high school. The misfits, goths, geeks, and artists, I desperately longed to feel like one of them. And ultimately, college brought me the necessary moments of being an outcast, or at least feeling like one, that are often essential to life as an artist. I pushed myself further and further artistically, but oftentimes it was just too much, and I was left in a puddle of tears from the sheer effort, emotion, and loneliness of it all. My most conscious moment of facing this was during rehearsals for a play called Tell Me the Truth About Love. I must have been having a difficult day of it, because during rehearsal, when the time came for my solo, I couldn't open my mouth. I burst into tears instead. Terribly embarrassed in front of my hyper-talented and cynical classmates, I ran off stage to catch my breath and collect myself. Seconds later, I was followed by our director, a man in his 60s who was not particularly suited to the challenges of instructing budding young adults. He cornered me, and for the rest of my classmates to hear, screamed at me about how a professional would never do such a thing and how I would never make it in the theater world without a thick skin. I responded by sobbing harder. I never was able to make it back onto stage that day. I still have a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach when I remember that show. But even though I couldn't make it back onto the stage that day, the next day I did. And the day after that, and the day after that. I faced my embarrassment, I nailed the solo in the show, and I proved to myself that I couldn't be intimidated. I was a dedicated, reliable, and talented performer, and despite the director's crushing words, I did become a professional actor. There's a saying in the acting world, an actor must have the skin of an elephant and the soul of a rose. I think that's good advice for any creative person. Developing a thick skin is not about crushing that part of you that is sensitive and open to the world. That's the part that makes you need to create. But what defines that thick skin and makes you a professional is your ability to keep putting yourself out there in spite of the inevitable rejection, embarrassment, and moments of feeling out of place. All you can do is walk back out there the next day, and the day after that, and the day after that. It's crazy how close Autumn's story is to mine. A painter and an actor. How about a designer? And just to shake things up even more, this story didn't happen in a classroom 15 years ago. This is the criticism that stylist and interior designer Emily Henderson is facing today online. Emily Henderson, stylist, designer, blogger. Most days I get three kinds of criticism. From the three kinds of people, the angry, the jealous, and the disappointed. The angry write me emails saying, you may as well throw shit on the walls and call it design. What you do, my 2-year-old could do. You are a piece of shit and you should quit or kill yourself. I don't get those very often, thank goodness. Those comments are disturbing, because it's always jarring to know that what I do, design, not politics, not religion, is the victim of someone else's total unhappiness and self-hatred. It doesn't make me question my work. It makes me buy a security system for my house. I'm not kidding. The jealouses troll on sites with lots of, ugh, if I have to see one more pic of her fat baby, I'll stab my eyes out. Or, look how perfect her life looks with her perfect baby, and it's totally obvious her husband is gay. Ugh. Let's face it. Anything involving my children pisses me off, but the sentiment is more that they see me happy, possibly happier than I used to be, clearly happier than they are, and they are envious of said happiness. Fine. The worst criticism is from the disappointed, from the people who used to be fans, who used to follow my work and read every day, but have stopped. As I've gotten more successful and the blog has gotten bigger, they feel I've changed. And they aren't wrong. That's why it stings, and exactly why it's helpful. Those disappointed fans, and there were a lot of them, made me so sad, embarrassed, ashamed, and then mad that I was forced to feel ashamed of my own happiness, and ultimately led me to take a step back, pretend I was a reader, and adjust. If you have a point of view in success, you will have haters. Congratulations. But when the people that are hating on you are exactly the same people that helped you grow your success from the beginning, and they are consistently all saying the same thing over and over, then you better perk up and listen and make some changes. Success clouds your brain and makes it easy for you to think that everyone will love you no matter what, that you have thousands of cheerleaders in your pocket all the time. You don't. You have to try every day to be better, to create more, succeed harder, improve, and impress yourself and others. Perk up, listen, and make some changes. This is one of the reasons why I admire Emily so much. That stinging, burning criticism that made her sad didn't stop her. Because when you trust the source of your criticism, you should listen, adjust, and move forward. Finally, because these stories are just too good not to share, I've asked two incredibly accomplished visual artists to relive their very defining encounters with criticism. Anthony Zinanos, illustrator and collage artist. You have poor drawing skills. Those crushing words came out of a tall, bear-like tutor who seemed like he would have been more at home working as a football coach or a lumberjack hacking down trees all day, not dealing with overly sensitive 18-year-old art students who each had dreams of becoming the next Picasso. It was the matter-of-fact way that he said it that really struck me. As if he were just stating the obvious, like, you are wearing black shoes. Needless to say, those words ended my drawing career. Just hearing the phrase, life drawing class, made me break out in a cold sweat. Thinking about it now, though, if not for that tutor, I would not have pursued photography and collage so intently, leading me to my career today. So I'd like to say thank you, the bear, what I and the other students used to call him, and whose name I seem to have selectively blocked out. Your words might have been harsh and soul-crushing at the time, but now, 15 years later, I can fully appreciate your criticism and push it into the right direction. Martha Rich, artist and teacher. When I was heading off to college at 18, I had a vague idea that I would study art. I was lucky enough to have gone to a high school that had an art major, and so it made sense to continue studying art at the liberal arts college where I had been accepted. The college wasn't known for its art program. I had picked that college mostly because of the cute guys playing frisbee on the quad. When I went off to college, my mom was battling cancer and had been since I was 16. I was pretty aimless and sensitive and going through the motions of what you were supposed to do at this time in your life. So I took all of the required 101 classes, including drawing. That drawing class was a struggle for me. The teacher told me I couldn't draw, and I believed him. In my fragile state of mind, I quit art altogether and graduated with a degree in sociology and anthropology. I didn't make art again until I was 35 and going through a divorce. A traumatic experience took me away from art, and another brought me back. Art is in me. I couldn't keep it buried. Something was missing. So, to cope with the divorce, I decided to take an illustration class. The rest is history. Turn criticism into creative fuel. In all of these stories, there is a common thread. If you don't allow the knock-you-on-your-ass criticism to stop you, you can actually use it as fuel to propel yourself forward. Hopefully, it won't take years for that forward movement to kick in. Ultimately, all five of us can now say, thank you, harsh critics. If it weren't for you and your jarring words, I never would have found this new path. Or something a little less polite than that. Now, even if you're able to triumph over your own bear, it most likely won't be the last battle you'll fight. You'll run into more criticism along the way, but you will be ready. Slowly but surely, you'll get better at taking mean-spirited criticism with a grain of salt, and will learn to embrace it when it's actually helpful. Like dealing with your inner critic, you should take whatever you can from the criticism that makes sense to you, ignore the bits that had absolutely no value, and then move on. Easier said than done, I know, but here are a few of my best tips for turning criticism into creative fuel. Put the gloves down. It's human nature. The moment you get feedback that you don't want, your defenses go up. But put the gloves down long enough to listen, and there might be some valuable gems for you there. Is there any truth to the criticism? Even just a nagging little bit that you might agree with. And perhaps that's why you're defending that choice so ferociously. There's a theory that the people we dislike the most are often those who display the traits we dislike in ourselves. It can be the same with blunt criticism. Let your guard down for just a minute. Listen carefully for the truths. If there are any, take them and move on, swiftly. Say it out loud. As we've noted, many of us are ashamed of these stories, and so we just tuck them away where they repeat inside our heads. Negative criticism has power in there, but you can take that power away. Share your story with someone you trust, a friend, your mom, a like-minded studio mate. As soon as you say it out loud, it's not nearly as upsetting, and you might even find a bit of humor in it. Or not. But at least now you've got one more person in your corner making sure that you don't quit. Criticism of your work is not criticism of you. Put that up on your fridge so you don't forget. I know, it's very easy to equate yourself with your work, but when someone gives feedback, whether helpful or harsh, it's not a comment on you as a person. It's simply someone's subjective opinion on a painting or a performance or a chunk of writing. And since there is so much more to you than that piece of work, you can't possibly take it personally, right? Click delete. Ah, the internet. A vast source of cruel, faceless criticism from people who would never have the courage to say such things to your face. Yet, a comment field allows them to run wild. You want to defend yourself, to fight back against that faceless critic as you read his mean words at 2 a.m.? Don't. Just click delete. Do it. There is no point in engaging. In fact, that's often what these cowards are looking for. A bit of entertainment at your expense. They don't deserve your time. They deserve the delete button. Pick up your pencil. These wise words are one of my favorite bits of advice on negative criticism. They come from Canadian painter-designer Amanda Happe. No one can wrestle the pencil out of your hand. You get to keep going in absolute defiance. Brilliant. And oh so true. The first time I read this, it was one of her answers to my creative block interview, my heart skipped a beat. I immediately thought about that very defining critique in my last year of university and suddenly had a major aha moment. I had always blamed my professor for the drastic halt in my artistic life, but he didn't put my pencil down. I did. It was my responsibility to pick it back up. Don't let anyone else put your pencil down. Keep going in absolute defiance. Chapter 8. Failure leads to genius. When I started writing this book, I was frozen with fear, in a full-on panic attack. I was absolutely terrified to fail, and then a wonderful friend sent me this quote. "An artist cannot fail. It is a success to be one." Charles Horton Cooley. So true, Charles. So true. I had already succeeded just by showing up at my keyboard. Failing would have been letting the fear win, closing my laptop, and walking away. I wasn't going to do that, so technically failure wasn't even a possibility. Quitting something that you're passionate about, or being too scared to start, is the only way that we can define failure. Everything else, all those crumpled papers on the floor, is not failure. It is a beginning. A whole floor full of beginnings, in fact. Those papers are experiments, in-progress ideas, exciting mistakes that might just be on their way to something brilliant. Thomas Edison created 10,000 prototypes of the light bulb before he got it right. But if he'd thrown his hands up and quit at prototype 9,999, he would have failed. The moral of the story? Keep going. Explore. Make mistakes. Play some more. Make more mistakes. Learn. And enjoy every moment of your wonderful and perfect creative journey. In this chapter, you'll get some fuel to keep your engine humming. Quote of the day. Charles Horton Cooley's inspiring quote is among literally hundreds of well-known quotes about how to put your failure into perspective. You've probably even recited at least one of them at some point. It's great that so many clever people want us to know that we can overcome failure. However, these very insightful words have been so overquoted and so widely shared all over the internet that they've become pop culture wallpaper that we barely even notice anymore. They're something you scroll past on Pinterest while you're looking for cool tattoo ideas. Okay, yes, I might have been looking for cool tattoo ideas when I stumbled across this one. Failure is a bruise, not a tattoo. John Sinclair. Normally, I would have glanced right over this beautifully typeset quote and continued scrolling, but this time, because I was writing this chapter and failure was top of mind, it stopped me in my tracks. I actually read it. It's brilliant and true. Failure is a momentary setback, just a bruise, that absolutely does not have to affect you for the rest of your life. Obviously, I immediately changed my search from tattoos to inspirational quotes, comma, failure, and away I went. I found a ridiculous number of very smart sayings, and it turns out they're even more impactful when you actually read them. Who knew? Now, you have to promise me that you won't skim over this little list of inspirational wisdom. I've gathered quotes from Van Gogh to Winston Churchill, and with a range like that, you know it will be good. Put these up on your wall, and on days when you're feeling like quitting, read them. Actually read them. The master has failed more times than the beginner has ever tried. Stephen McCraney. I have not failed. I have just found 10,000 ways that don't work. Thomas Edison. Failure is the condiment that gives success its flavor, Truman Capote. Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts. Winston Churchill. There is no innovation and